Case number 13-1261, Jared R. Clark, petitioner versus Federal Labor Relations Authority. Mr. Hudson for the petitioner, Mr. Jacob for the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, Zach Hudson, court-appointed amicus. I've reserved 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case presents two issues, whether this court has jurisdiction and then the merits of Mr. Clark's petition for review. I'll start with jurisdiction, but hope to have some time to discuss the arbitrary and capricious nature of the authority's action in this case. Viewed in concert, the authority's arguments stand for the extraordinary proposition that it can delegate all of its powers to its general counsel and in doing so, avoid judicial review altogether. Outside the litigation context, we know
that you can do that if you're the general counsel of the NLRB, right? If you have an informal settlement of the NLRB, no judicial review, right? I mean, that's pretty clear.
Yes, Your Honor.
The question for me, at least, is why doesn't Turgeon tell us that we're supposed to treat the general counsel for the FLRA just like we're supposed to treat the general counsel for the NLRB? Your brief does a great job of, I think, avoiding that issue by telling us that Turgeon is limited to decisions before the complaint. But isn't the real learning of Turgeon, at least for this case, that when we see the general counsel for the FLRA involved in a informal settlement, we're supposed to think we're looking at the general counsel for the NLRB, and in that case, we know the answer. Why doesn't that resolve the issue on jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor. The critical difference between the board's view of its general counsel powers and the authority's view of the general counsel's powers is that we know for a fact that they're different. We know that the authority thinks, outside the litigation context at least, that when a settlement occurs, that is an exercise of authority powers and not the general counsel's prosecutorial powers. When the Department of Justice asked the authority to explain the settlement power because it was apparently skeptical of the existence of any such power, the authority told the Department of Justice unequivocally that the general counsel can do three things: investigate and file complaints, prosecute complaints, and then exercise other powers of the authority as the authority may prescribe.
But didn't the Supreme Court resolve that in the UCFW, was it Local 23 case? I mean, prior to that time, we were thinking about things, a distinction between prosecutorial and adjudicatory. But after that case, don't we see things differently? And that opinion was before that case, right?
That's true, Your Honor. The UCFW opinion did follow the right authority decision on the scope of the prosecutorial powers of the general counsel.
And you don't think it changes it, though?
I don't think it changes it, Your Honor, because the authority never said that it did. The only statement that we have from the authority qua authority on the settlement power is the decision in response to the Department of Justice request for a description of that power.
So in Local 23, the Supreme Court looked at the purpose when Congress enacted the NLRA in the separation of prosecutorial and adjudicatory functions. It looked at the structure of the statute, which is somewhat different here. It looked at the legislative history, which I haven't found where it answers the question. And then it looked at whether there was a consistent agency position. But it kept coming back to the notion that the statute said the general counsel could take final action. And then it said common sense. If you have a prosecutor who can decide whether to file a complaint, it's only rational to say that he can withdraw it if he can. As I understood the Supreme Court to view the situation that we have here is once the general counsel decides to enter into a unilateral agreement, you're sort of back in the statutory framework of a pre-complaint situation. And why doesn't that analysis apply here?
Your Honor, a couple of answers. First, The Supreme Court in the UFCW case recognized that there's a spectrum from prosecutorial to adjudicatorial functions, and in that case ultimately decided that when the board's general counsel was settling matters, it was exercising its prosecutorial function because of deference to the board's position on that matter. That was a litigation position that was taken by the board in UFCW, and Justice Brennan and the rest of the court found that persuasive in that case. But here we have the exact opposite position from the authority outside the litigation context. But to speak to the statute directly, you reference the final authority language in the board general counsel's statutory provision. If you look at the two statutory provisions side by side, the statutory provision outlining the authority's general counsel powers and the statutory provision outlining the board general counsel's powers, you'll see that that final authority on behalf of the board language is absent in the authority statute. The authority statute does not have the prefatory language that the Supreme Court relied on in the board case, which gives the general counsel final authority on behalf of the board to do various things.
So, as I understand the board's position, the critical point of Local 23 is this purpose of separating, and that if it's somewhat ambiguous, the court applied Chevron and deferred to the board's reasonable interpretation of what was prosecutorial as opposed to adjudicatory. Why doesn't that apply here as well?
Well, initially, I think it's important to note that we're talking about the timeline of these cases. UFCW was decided in 1987, 3 years after Chevron, and Chevron was still kind of finding its footing at that time, so it's not at all clear to me that the Supreme Court or this court would defer to the board's litigation position in the same way the court did in UFCW, which is not to say that...
I don't see this court stepping back on Chevron in that regard, counsel, where the Supreme Court has a case out there that says it's applying Chevron deference.
Again, Your Honor, there the court was deferring to the board's litigation position that it was the prosecutorial power of the general counsel to settle cases. Here, we have a non-litigation position that the authority has taken in response to a Department of Justice request where it says unequivocally that a settlement is an exercise of the authority's powers and not the general counsel's prosecutorial powers.
Yeah, so I understand there's that odd 1986 statement, refusing to answer but answering. That's why I went back to look at the actual text and those factors that the Supreme Court had thought were relevant to its conclusion. So when I look at the statute here, the statute is different, and the legislative history just says, well, the two general counsels, we intend the FLRA general counsel to be akin to the NLRA general counsel.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. The statute is different. As I pointed out, if you look at the powers of the general counsel side by side, they are in fact different. But the regulations here also matter if we're talking about deference.
Right. So the critical point here is that the only way the general counsel gets his authority is through these joint regulations issued by the authority and the general counsel?
I think that is one of the important points, but another important point is just to look at the regulation that the authority relies on for the first time in this court. As the court knows, the authority now concedes that it relied on the wrong regulation in settling Mr. Clark's case, affirming that settlement, and then moving to dismiss Mr. Clark's settlement in Mr. Clark's case in this court. But the new regulation it relies on, Section 2423.25, eviscerates the notion that settlement is a purely prosecutorial function. If you look at that regulation, the post-complaint regulation, it provides for two types of settlements, informal settlements and formal settlements. And the formal settlements require review and approval of the authority. That's Part C. And then Part D provides for a settlement judge program where administrative law judges step in and help to referee the settlement process. So if the authority was correct that settlement was purely a prosecutorial power of the general counsel, then its own regulations impinge on that authority.
If we were to agree with you, help us write the opinion that gets around the language in Turgeon that says we're supposed to look at the general counsel for the FLRA the same way we are as the general counsel for the NRB. To me, that's your biggest problem. Your statutory argument, I get that, and hey, I'm all for statutory arguments, but here we have precedent that relies on legislative history that just, at the very least, difficult for you to get around. So how would you write that opinion?
Your Honor, as
give me the first draft.
Your Honor, I would say this. Turgeon is limited to the issue that was before it, which is whether or not a general counsel's decision not to issue an unfair labor practice complaint is reviewable in this court. And the court could simply say, if you look at the text of the statute, it's quite clear that the general counsel has the authority entrusted to it by Congress to decide whether or not to issue an unfair labor practice complaint. Once a complaint is issued, however, as Turgeon itself recognizes, the issuance of a complaint is a game changer. It triggers the authority's adjudicatory powers and authorizes the authority to do a number of things that it cannot do in the absence of such a complaint. For example, it assigns...
That language in the legislative history, we would have to say, we're supposed to treat them for all intents and purposes the same until a complaint's filed, right?
No, Your Honor. I mean, first of all, again, and I don't want to point to this decision too often, but it is very powerful in this point. One difference is that the board and the authority apparently view the general counsel's prosecutorial powers differently. So that seems to be critical, and that's absent in the UCW case, the decision that we have here in response to the Department of Justice's inquiry about the settlement power. But this court's precedents are also clear that while the board and the authority are similar in many respects, and oftentimes the board and the authority precedents should be treated similarly, at the end of the day, authority cases, authority precedent, and the authority statute has to control the outcome of an authority case. So the fact that Turgeon talks about the comparable nature of board authority and authority doesn't mean that this court should just apply board precedent without further evaluation. And we think that if this court does look at the statute, look at the regulations, and look at the legislative history, it's absolutely clear that the board general counsel and the authority general counsel should not be treated the same for purposes of the review of a unilateral settlement, a post-complaint unilateral settlement.
What do you draw from the legislative history as support?
I don't really think that there's much that legislative history says much either way about the settlement power. It does say that the power whether or not to decide to issue a complaint is entrusted to the general counsel. We concede that. But that doesn't really speak to the question of whether or not the settlement power is entrusted to the general counsel. And in fact, if you look at the statute, you know, we did argue that there's really no root in the statute for a settlement power. But if you read all of the provisions together, it's pretty clear that if there's a settlement power at all, it resides with the authority. In section 7105A2G, I believe it is, Congress gave the authority the power to hold hearings on and resolve complaints. So a settlement would seem much more like a resolution of a complaint than anything else that's in the statute. And the closest thing for the general counsel in terms of having the power to unilaterally settle a complaint after it's filed would be in 7118A2, where the general counsel has the power to issue regulations for the informal resolution of unfair labor practice charges before the issuance of a complaint. So the only statutory hook for a post-complaint unilateral settlement authority is really for the authority qua authority and not the general counsel. And again, Judge Rogers referenced the regulations and the fact that these have been jointly issued, and then I talked about how the authority, in fact, has preserved a role for itself to step in some of these settlement procedures. But the authority decision in response to the Department of Justice's request for guidance on the settlement power says that it's delegating its power to settle cases to the general counsel. So again, we don't have to read into the regulations or guess as to what's happening here. We know exactly what happened.
So you think this is a Chevron step one analysis as opposed to step two?
With respect to the jurisdictional question, if Chevron applies at all, it probably applies at step two. And the thing to defer to would be the authority's decision with respect to its settlement power in response to the Department of Justice.
But so you would say, what, it's just a de novo determination? We look at the statutes and the regulations. There's no deference whatsoever?
Your Honor, if there's deference, we think the appropriate thing to defer to would be the authority's decision saying that the settlement power is an authority power. But if, and also to the regulations, which make clear that it's
1986 statement and the regulations?
And the regulations, yes. But if Chevron does not apply, then the court looks at it de novo and comes to its own conclusions. And we think that the regulations without deference to anything and the statute without deference to anything would make clear that a post-complaint unilateral settlement is an action of the authority qua authority, and thus this court has jurisdiction to review that settlement under section 7123 of the authority's organic statute. And it's important to note that the authority's position is not just that this court lacks jurisdiction, it's that no court has jurisdiction to review this settlement. So if this court concludes that it does not have jurisdiction under Section 7123, then no court has jurisdiction to review it. And given the merits of Mr. Clark's case and the other 55 non-members excluded from the settlement, that would be fundamentally unfair. This is a textbook violation of the labor law here. The union in this case excluded non-members because of their non-member status, told non-members if they wanted to participate in the settlement, they had to join the union, and then tried to sweep it all under the rug after the authority got involved. And so if there's ever a case where all of the bells and whistles of an authority remedy...
Your client got as much as anyone in the settlement. He got the maximum that was awarded to anyone. So you're not going to get more than that, right? Well, you're not going to get your $45,000 from this, right?
That's probably right, Your Honor. But there are 55 other non-members who
Does
are...
Does he have standing to represent them? Is he representing them?
So he is challenging the settlement, and the settlement covers both him and the 55 non-members. So the merits of the settlement speak to disposition.
But if we were to decide he wasn't injured by the settlement in any way, does he have standing to represent those who only got $200?
He has standing to challenge the settlement on the merits because the settlement failed to offer him the remedy that he sought, which includes
Which would be what? What's the remedy he wants besides getting the maximum amount that anyone got under the settlement?
A notice posting in the workplace, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. The authority's own precedents make absolutely clear that the bread and butter remedy for an unfair labor practice is a notice posting in the workplace, which is important for a number of reasons. The notice posting in the workplace lets individuals at the workplace know that the union in fact violated the labor law, which hopefully serves a deterrent function moving forward. But also, there were other non-members who weren't included in this settlement. And when someone decides not to join a union at a government workplace, they're exercising a statutory right. And a notice posting lets those individuals know that that right is being protected by the government in the way that Congress intended. And unless the court has more questions right now, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. All right. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Fred Jacob. I'm the solicitor of the Federal Labor Relations Authority. With me is Zachary Hennigy, who is a deputy solicitor. Together, we ask this Court to dismiss Mr. Clark's petition for review for lack of jurisdiction. One thing is clear. Congress only intended the orders of the authority to be appealable to the Courts of Appeals. No court has disagreed with that basic principle, and no court has countenanced any appeal of a general counsel decision to courts of appeals. They have been universally rejected, and this court's decision in Turgeon and this court's subsequent decision in POPA make very clear that the general counsel has exclusive discretion over the issuance and control of complaints. The general counsel is indeed the master of the complaint.
How should we think about the 1986 policy statement that Mr. Hudson referred to?
And that's an excellent question, Your Honor. I think one thing that Mr. Clark's amicus has done here is he has plucked out a single sentence from a relatively thorough opinion and cherry-picked that sentence in a way that is incongruous with the rest of the opinion. What the authority did in that 1986 opinion was several things. It repeatedly stated that the power to settle informally is consistent with the statutory duties of the FLRA's general counsel. It said
but
that twice.
When I read that, I thought, well, if the FLRA had delegated this unilateral post-complaint settlement authority, you could still write that sentence, that the general counsel has authority because it was delegated by the FLRA. So that, I didn't think, really advanced your argument here.
Well, Your Honor, I think that is one way to read the 1986 opinion, I suppose. We would argue that the better way to read it is consistent with all the other authority on this matter.
All I meant was that when the authority question is answered, we are told to look at the regulations jointly issued by the authority and the general counsel. Now, I know you're not arguing the general counsel can enhance its powers beyond the statutory authorization, but presumably beyond the pre-filing of the charge, would not the general counsel's authority have to come from the authority?
Well, the position that our reading of the statute is that the general counsel has the post-complaint power, the final and unreviewable discretion after complaint is issued to withdraw the complaint, consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in UFCW.
So your position is, despite the textual differences, and what I'll say is legislative history that really doesn't answer this particular question, and the fact that the 1986 statement by the authority may reasonably be read as inconsistent with its current position. Are we just back at common sense, and when Congress uses the word akin and we refer to akin, we mean the same as?
Well, Your Honor, the 1986 statement of policy, again, turns as well on the statutory grant of power. The differences between the NLRA and the statute, the Federal Service Labor Management Relations Statute, are insignificant for the purposes of this analysis. If you compare the two statutes, the NLRA gives the board's general counsel the power to file complaints, to investigate complaints, issue complaints, and prosecute complaints, and possess other duties as the board may prescribe. The authority statute does the exact same thing for the general counsel. The other thing is that
so,
in this...
So is the result of that argument that the general counsel gets his post-filing of the charge authority from the authority?
The general counsel's power to file a complaint or to withdraw a complaint is the flip side of his power to issue the complaint, certainly before a hearing starts.
That's the common sense argument.
That's the argument that the authority maintains before the court and is consistent with the 1986 opinion. If I can just continue, the sentence that opposing counsel has plucked out of that opinion is not complete in the brief. The sentence says it is one of the other powers as delegated in Appendix B of the authority's regulations. If one looks at Appendix B of the authority's regulations, Appendix B lists a whole host of powers, from the clearly prosecutorial to the clearly delegated, from investigating complaints, filing complaints, prosecuting complaints, settling complaints, to truly delegated powers like the power to file for injunctions in federal district court or to deal with representation and election matters on behalf of the authority. Appendix B is a necessary step in reading the 1986 opinion, and I think what is also equally as necessary in reading the 1986 opinion is, again, abstracting, as Judge Griffith suggested, to the broader congressional intent that this court reflected in Turgeon to make the powers of the general counsel essentially identical.
You suggested that the filing of a complaint and the withdrawal of a complaint are just flip sides of the same coin, but that's not what we have here. We have the withdrawal of a complaint accompanied by a settlement, right?
Correct.
And that's a significantly different factor. We now have different people involved, and the allegations here is that the settlement was unfair to some. So in that case, what is the remedy that someone like Mr. Clark might have here, where hypothetically, let's imagine there is an unfair settlement. What recourse does he or she have?
Well, Your Honor, the authority has provided for internal review of any settlement decision.
Long as the general counsel's last word on it, that's it?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what the statute contemplates. It's no different than certainly a disappointed...
Just another example of Congress having the power to be unfair?
That's right, Your Honor. I mean, Congress wanted to encourage settlements. Congress wanted to encourage the quick resolution of disputes, and Congress, after 30 years of working with the Taft-Hartley vision of the National Labor Relations Act, where the general counsel had unreviewable discretion to issue complaints, withdraw complaints, They decide. Congress decided to import that model to the authority.
Can you educate me for a minute? What's the difference between a formal settlement and an informal settlement?
And that's an excellent question, Your Honor. I mean, I think opposing counsel made this point that the settlement power he suggested that we're arguing that the settlement power is exclusively the general counsel's. The statute is a remedial statute, and every component of the authority has an obligation, or certainly the duty, to try to settle complaints in an amicable way. So the difference between an informal settlement and a formal settlement is a formal settlement. An informal settlement is a settlement that the general counsel reaches with the charging party or with a respondent after complaint is issued, if we're talking about post-complaint settlements, and decides it without further process. A formal settlement, which is also modeled on the NLRB's process, receives the approval of the authority. And it may be a case where...
Yeah, what would be the circumstances that it would reach to that level?
It may be a case where the authority wants to be able to seek court enforcement of that order, so the power of contempt to ensure that a respondent complies.
And that's subject to judicial review, right?
I mean, and that would be subject to judicial review. But there would be certainly, I mean, perhaps it was a particularly contumacious union that was refusing to respect the union employee rights. And the authority said, the general counsel
You're
said...
You're saying that Congress set up a scheme in which the general counsel, in effect, gets to decide whether there's judicial review. If he or she wants there to be judicial review, he or she will involve the board in a formal settlement, or the authority in a formal settlement. But if not...
Ultimately, what Congress did was, Congress set up a scheme whereby the general counsel, who's on the ground, or the regional director, who's on the ground interacting with the parties, assessing the merits of the case, can make the first call on whether or not this is a case that's worth going to hearing, and can determine whether or not a particular settlement would effectuate the statutory purposes. It may be that
I'm puzzled by the on-off switch for the role of the courts here.
Sure, and I understand, Your Honor. The role of the courts, again, in that situation, the general counsel or the regional director has to make a determination of whether an authority review and a formal authority order that presumably would be reviewable by the courts, probably in a summary fashion, because there would be an agreement to comply with whatever court order.
Any guidelines given to regional directors and the general counsel as to when something will be a formal settlement and involve the authority and not, or is it just left up to the discretion of the
I mean, certainly the regulations provide for separate criteria. I would assume there are also authority decisions, but I'd have to go back and look into it. There certainly are criteria, and again, I think it turns on whether or not the violation or the parties, whether the violation of the parties are serious enough that the role of the courts in terms of enforcing authority orders might need to be invoked.
Let me ask you, when you answered Judge Griffith's question about what is the difference between an informal and a formal settlement, as I heard you, you said an informal settlement is where the parties agree. Well, here, you mean the union and the general counsel, and Mr. Clark simply is not a party, even though he's the one who brought the complaint to the general counsel. Mm-hmm. So he's cut out at that point.
Correct. I mean, and perhaps if I stated...
So he has no remedy, is the response to Judge Griffith's question, under this scheme.
Under this scheme, Your Honor, and this could happen with a formal settlement as well. A formal settlement could be unilateral as well, where the general counsel in the region working with the parties, or the regional director working with the respondent, I should say, so perhaps I used the wrong term, working with the respondent to the charge, decides to settle a complaint and settle charges to him in a manner that's appropriate. Mm-hmm. Mr. Clark's review is he has administrative review to the general counsel, just as if under the same scheme under the National Labor Relations Act. And it's appropriate. Again, Your Honor, the problem with Mr. Clark's argument is that it's somewhat unworkable. The argument in his brief is that once complaint issues, no case should be allowed to settle. He says the general counsel has no settlement power.
I didn't understand it to be that quite, but maybe you're right, is that there's authority to settle, but the general counsel at that point is the authority. And so what the general counsel does is subject to judicial review. I thought that was the argument. Not that the general counsel can't settle. It's that he's or she is not operating pursuant to independent statutory authority.
I believe the certainly in Mr. Clark's opening brief and Amicus' opening brief, it's a much broader argument than that. It suggests...
Go ahead.
But I believe it suggests that there's no hearing, that the authority does not possess the power to settle the case.
So I want to go back to you making the point on this distinction between formal and informal settlements, that it's up to the discretion of the general counsel to decide whether this goes up to the authority to make it a formal settlement, and it's based on some regulatory criteria. And I think you used the phrase something like, if it's serious enough. Mm-hmm. So I take it from this, the judgment was made that this was not serious enough to bring the authority in.
Well, Your Honor, I think those are the criteria, and perhaps, again, I'm not using technical legal terms. You know, is there a risk that the respondent is a recidivist? And is there a risk of...
Well, let's talk about this case here. So was the judgment...
And I would assume in this case that the regional director and the respondent engaged in productive settlement talks, were able to settle the case with no fear that the respondent would not comply, that there was no risk of respondent being a recidivist, or at least limited risk, and that the general counsel felt satisfied that for all the reasons the regional director stated in his letter to Mr. Clark, that this was an adequate and appropriate settlement. The vast majority of our cases settle after complaint, over 90% of them.
The phrase that Amicus used was pennies on the dollar settlement, and that is a pretty accurate description of...
With all the respect, Your Honor, that's an entirely inaccurate description.
How so?
Mr. Clark, I think one of the problems here is that Mr. Clark misapprehends the nature of the unfair labor practice that occurred. The unfair labor practice wasn't that the union engaged in a bad settlement. No one's questioned the union's settlement. The unfair labor practice was that the union excluded non-members from the settlement. To be fair, the union also excluded members from the settlement, but it did exclude non-members from the settlement as well. And the remedy for that unfair labor
practice...
There was
only one union member in the first settlement, isn't that right?
Or non-union member. But in terms of excluded members, there were also a number of non-members, union members as well, who were excluded from the settlement, which is one of the reasons why the general counsel felt that it was appropriate to settle the case, because this is not a case that's been before a judge, or for an administrative law judge for hearing. We don't know how it would have played out. The general counsel...
It wouldn't have played out well.
It may not have played out well. Yeah. This is the issuance of complaint is what focuses the parties on settlement. In the vast majority of cases, my understanding is that many of our cases, we don't even receive a response from the respondent until complaint is issued. So to withdraw this power from the general counsel to withdraw a complaint and settle a case once complaint is issued would eviscerate the basic goals of settling the case.
No, what I'm just trying to get at is why this one wouldn't have become a formal settlement so that...
I suppose it's because I think the settlement...
Seems egregious to me, but...
And I think the general counsel felt that he got a good remedy, that Mr. Clark was compensated fully. The other 55 non-members didn't file charges themselves, and there could have been some timeliness issues in terms of their having received a full remedy, that there was a notice that went to all the non-members who received some settlement saying this was settling an unfair labor practice charge. Ultimately, Your Honors, this is a case where there is no meaningful distinction beyond one perhaps sentence that's plucked out of a 20-year-old, 30-year-old decision that was before UFCW to distinguish between, there's no meaningful reason to distinguish between the powers of the general counsel of the NLRB and the powers of the general counsel of the FLRA.
So the situation we have is if the union repeats its conduct, the general counsel has the authority to resolve it, period, without any review by the authority, much less of a court.
If the union repeated the same conduct, Your Honor, the general counsel would investigate the charge, issue a complaint if there was merit.
It's troubling is you have a regional director with these very strong findings, and you have a settlement that, at least from the complaining party's point of view, doesn't give him the remedy that he thinks is very important. And your point is that's just a prosecutorial judgment. It's not an adjudicatory judgment.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would quibble with the word use of the word findings. What is in the record is merely an investigative report that was that a regional field attorney gave to the regional director.
Right.
It's an assessment of the strengths and merits of
the
a case
that
typically wouldn't even be.
It?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The regional director never adopted it?
The regional director said, I don't think he adopted it as factual findings. He adopted it as essentially there's nothing more here than probable cause to have issued a complaint. There's been no other finding beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
All we have on the ground is an investigation that resulted in probable cause to issue a complaint. There's been no finding of wrongdoing. There's been no admission of wrongdoing. There's been a settlement, and there was probable cause to have issued a complaint, which pushed the parties to settle the case, to give Mr. Clark as much as anybody else got in the settlement, and to give all the other non-members basically a fair amount that was comparable to what other people received in the settlement.
And you say it's not pennies on the dollar?
It is absolutely not pennies on the dollar. So to basically wrap up that point, I'm sorry, I see I've gone over my time, is so Mr. Clark's beef is with the union settlement. He thinks that he should have gotten $45,000 or some very high sum of back pay for all the years that he performed this non-graded work.
Paid for.
That he yes. But Your Honor, nobody received that remedy. In fact, it's possible, as we note in our brief, that no one would have been entitled to that remedy because federal law limits the amount of back pay that people can receive for wrongly graded for performing misclassified work. So Mr. Clark's beef is with the admittedly unfair fact that he worked for many years at the wrong grade and in his mind didn't receive this large sum of money. But where the unfair labor practice lied, or at least the alleged unfair labor practice lied, was with the union's discrimination, that it didn't entitle Mr. Clark to the same $1,900 that somebody in his similarly situated.
Remind me, how many non-union members were included in the second settlement? We have Mr. Clark plus how many others?
55 others.
50, and they all got $200 each?
I believe that's correct.
And he got $1,900. Why did they get so little when he gets so much?
I believe, well, Mr. Clark was the charging party.
Okay.
He filed the charge and pursued it. None of the other 55 had filed timely charges with the authority or perceived it. Mr. Clark had presented all the evidence of his eligibility for the settlement. I don't think any of the others had. And there were many other people in the settlement who received $300, and I assume that working it out, the regional director felt that this was a fair sum for the other non-members who were excluded from the settlement compared to, you know, given the likelihood of success on the merits, given all the problems with remedy generally, because this was not a case where the remedy would have been clear.
It seems like they have two passes where the controlling feature is whether you're a member of the union or not. That seems to be the most elegant explanation for what's taking place here.
With the settlement or with the union?
Whether you were in the settlement the first time and then how much you got the second time.
That's right. Well, the ULP was discrimination against non-members, so non-members were compensated. Presumably, the members who were excluded, there's no allegation that there was any unlawful reason for having excluded the members.
So your basic position is that after Turgeon, the logic of that opinion compels the same result here, and we must dismiss.
The logic of Turgeon and the logic of POPA, Your Honor, which cited UFCW in the FLRA context approvingly. POPA very explicitly cites UFCW for the principle about general counsel's unreviewable power. It cites not a single page, but the entire discussion of UFCW. And it's clear to us, it's what we suggest, is that, again, there's no meaningful distinction in statute. The legislative history compels it. The 1986 decision, when read in its totality, also supports it.
I don't know why the statute compels it, counsel. I mean, that's what I'm having trouble with. I mean, if it was clear on its face that the general counsel, you know, has final decision-making authority. Authorities always taken this position. And legislative history says general counsel is exactly the same as the NLRA, general counsel. You know, that's your it's clear on its face argument. And this is a little fuzzier.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, the legislative history basically says that the powers are essentially identical, should be treated essentially. But there's no, with all due respect, there's no meaningful distinction.
And the key is just the distinction between the prosecutorial and adjudicatory function, that the statute is modeled closely enough to the NLRA, and with regard to the general counsel's power. And if there's any doubt, we defer to the authority's interpretation?
I think if the court wanted to take it in that direction, I think that's exactly right. That at the very least, to the extent there is doubt and ambiguity in the statute, which again is very similar to the NLRA, the authority has passed regulations giving this power, assigning it to the prosecutorial side of the house as opposed to the adjudicative side of the house. The regulations are very clear in having done that. The authority's consistent practice is very clear in having done that. And to the extent there's ambiguity in this 1986 opinion that dealt with a very specific matter, the authority did it there as well. It assigned it to that side of the house. So to the extent there is ambiguity.
You think there's no ambiguity until we get to the 1986 statement.
I would concede that's the only bit of ambiguity that's thrown into this.
Otherwise, it's clear on its face.
I agree, Your Honor. I think
I'm not agreeing.
I would agree with that position. I would agree with that position, with that statement, Your Honor. That aside from that one clause, phrase, not even the complete sentence, that one phrase in the 1986 opinion plucked out of the rest of it, this is a very straightforward, clear case.
Any legislative history on why Congress left out the word final decision?
Well, I think it's the Supreme Court explained that in UFCW, that the final authority on behalf of the board was not the same as the board. It was inserted because of the peculiarities of how Taft-Hartley was passed, that the House bill had proposed a separate agency. The Senate bill had nothing. It was making that clear. After 30 years of practice, Congress presumably didn't feel the need to restate that. At the time the statute was passed, we'd been operating under Taft-Hartley for 30 years. It was very well established that the General Counsel of the NLRB had those powers unreviewably.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Counsel for Petitioner.
Your Honor, my friend on the other side opened by saying this would be the first court to hold that settlements of this sort are reviewable. Of course, it would also be the first court to hold that settlements of this sort are not reviewable because there are no authority precedents speaking directly to this issue. So that's kind of a straw man that the other side has erected. And I'd initially like to clean up a couple of the factual issues that my friend on the other side referred to. This was, in fact, a settlement for pennies on the dollar. If you look at JA-57, which was the investigative attorney's report on this settlement, the attorney recommended a remedy of $1,389, quote, for each of the non-members who submitted a claim. Now, there is some ambiguity about what the 55 non-members did here, but it's absolutely clear that they received only $200, which is two-thirds of the lowest remedy received by the union employees included in the settlement in the first instance. And JA-57 is relevant for...
What did he say about Mr. Clark in that?
He did not specifically speak to Mr. Clark because this investigative report, in the recommendation section, because this investigative report actually dealt with two separate unfair labor practice charges simultaneously. So it's referring to one which the investigative attorney found to be untimely, and then Mr. Clark's, and then says that a good remedy would be the average of the settlement provided to the union, which is $1,389. JA-57 is also relevant for yet another reason. The authority at least suggested that the regional director didn't sign off on the findings of the investigative attorney, but it says after those findings are reported, quote, I agree with all of the above, which is the RD decision and comment. So that seems to pretty definitively answer the question whether or not the regional director adopted the findings of the report. And then if you look at JA-71, you'll see that Mr. Clark, one of the express reasons that he objected to the settlement in the first place was that it only pays other affected employees $200. There were 55 other known employees. So again, some of the attempts to throw some smoke up as to what happened here are unsuccessful if you just look at the record. Now, I was keeping track, and my friend said that we plucked this sentence from the 1986 decision on five separate occasions. But I would encourage this court, if it hasn't already, and I think it has, to read that decision, because it's hard to imagine something that's on more on all fours than with this case than this decision. And it's helpful in many more respects than just the sentence we quoted. In fact, we considered quoting the thing in its entirety in our brief. It's so helpful. It speaks to the Department of Justice's skepticism about the settlement power. It says it's one of the powers of the authority, not a prosecutorial power. It says it has delegated certain powers to the general counsel under 7104 F2. And then it also undermines the authority's claim that the sky will fall if these types of complaints, unilateral post-complaint settlements, are reviewable. Because in the very last paragraph of that decision, the authority says there are very few instances of such post-complaint settlements. Now, of course, that observation is a little bit dated, given the fact that this is a late 80s opinion, and we're now in the 2014. But if you look at the authority figures which they cite, on their website anyway, there are a couple hundred complaints filed every year, but 97% of those are resolved by a settlement that is agreed to, at least in part, by all of the parties. So the number of unilateral post-complaint settlements is likely very few. The one other thing to say is that, and I see I'm over my time, if I may make one more point. The regulation that the authority relies on this court is dispositive both with respect to jurisdiction and the merits. And I think this court already has the argument of jurisdiction, which is that if post-complaint settlement can be approved and reviewed by the authority or administered by these administrative law judges, then it simply can't be the case that post-complaint settlement is a purely prosecutorial decision. But that reliance on that regulation now is also dispositive on the merits. It's antithetical to the reasoned decision-making requirement of the APA to allow the authority to repeatedly rely on the wrong regulation and then switch horses midstream in this court. Had the authority relied on the right regulation below, it could have had the option of a formal settlement, which wasn't even on the table because it relied on the wrong regulation. It could have had the option of giving the matter to a settlement judge, which again wasn't even on the table because it relied on the wrong regulation. So that regulation, section 2423.25, really should result in a judgment for Mr. Clark, both on jurisdiction and the merits.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.